Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Okay, let's set the scene. Imagine Britain standing, well, utterly alone against the terrifying might of Nazi Germany.
A terrifying prospect.
It's very survival, just hanging by a thread. And at the helm, this one man who, through sheer defiance, became the unyielding symbol of his nation's resolve.
Winston Churchill.
Exactly. How did one individual come to embody such unwavering courage in really their darkest hour? That's the extraordinary journey we're embarking on today in this deep dive.
It's a huge question, isn't it? And to get at it, we're turning to Sir Martin Gilbert's monumental biography, Churchill, A Life.
Right.
And this isn't just, you know, another recounting of battles and speeches. Gilbert was Churchill's official biographer.
It's key. The access he had.
Unprecedented. Millions of private letters, government papers. He really lived and breathed this material, giving us this incredibly solid, evidence-driven account. Not just modern spin.
And what Gilbert reveals, it's a deep dive into how this complex, often flawed, sometimes marginalized figure.
Definitely flawed.
Was through, well, a lifetime of spectacular failures, actually, relentless ambition, and these profound insights, perfectly and almost unconsciously prepared for that indispensable role.
Mm.
So our mission today is to go beyond that popular caricature, the cigar, the V sign, and discover the multifaceted human behind the icon. We'll unpack how his character, his resilience, his foresight were forged over decades.
And crucially,
what universal lessons his extraordinary journey holds for you today.
Absolutely. Gilbert's argument really is that his destiny wasn't just chance. It was the culmination of a lifetime forged in fire, in a crucible.
Okay, let's unpack that journey then. Starting right at the beginning, Gilbert calls it the making of the man. This crucible of ambition and early adventures, roughly 1874 to 1900.
Right.
And what's really insightful is how his childhood, that emotionally neglected childhood, especially the distant relationship with his father, Lord Randolph Churchill.
Brilliant man, but remote.
Very. Gilbert argues this void wasn't just a personal struggle. It wasn't a weakness, but actually the foundational fuel for this lifelong, intense drive to achieve greatness. Like he was trying to impress a ghost or something.
Right.
How did that really shape him?
It's such a crucial point that that early neglect, it translated directly into this relentless quest for glory. His school record, Harrow, Sandhurst, frankly, pretty mediocre.
Yeah, not exactly top of the class.
Not at all. But as Gilbert shows, that didn't stop him. Instead, he deliberately sought out adventure. He became the swashbuckling young army officer, a war correspondent.
Where do you go?
Cuba, the Malakand Field Force in India. And famously, he was in the last great cavalry charge in British history at Omdurman in Sudan.
Wow.
He was constantly putting himself in harm's way, chasing distinction, almost like he had to prove his worth through sheer action, you know.
And that drive, that thirst for action, Gilbert really shows how it all came together in the Second Boer War, doesn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
His capture, that incredible escape, it made him a national hero practically overnight. How did he leverage that? Because he turned it into a political career so fast.
It was an amazing start. Gilbert highlights how Churchill, always the pragmatist, instantly used that hero status. He won his first seat in Parliament in 1900.
Just like that.
It wasn't just about fame, it was seizing the moment. A trait you see again and again throughout his life.
And his early political career was just as, well, audacious. Let's move into that period, say 1901 to 1914. A rising politician, full of nerve, and maybe surprisingly, a strong progressive streak.
Yes, very much so. In 1904, he did something pretty radical for the time.
He crossed the floor, right?
Yeah.
Defected from the conservatives to the liberals.
A huge move. He didn't just switch parties, he dramatically walked across the aisle. Gilbert portrays this as driven by, well, both principle, he was big on free trade, and of course, that relentless ambition we mentioned.
Must have caused a massive stir.
Oh, definitely. A calculated risk, but it paid off. Gilbert makes it clear that as a minister in the new liberal government, he became this, well, unlikely champion of radical social reform.
An aristocrat pushing for social change. Seems contradictory.
It does. But Gilbert highlights how these weren't really contradictions, but part of his pragmatic problem-solving approach, he pushed for things like labor exchanges, early job centers, essentially unemployment insurance, even minimum wage laws.
So it wasn't just grandstanding.
No, Gilbert suggests he saw the need. He had this maybe inherent sympathy for the underdog, but also pragmatism. Strengthening the nation meant addressing these issues. He was learning to adapt, understand different parts of society, skills that would be vital later.
Fascinating. And this foresight, this understanding of modern challenges, wasn't just social stuff, was it? He took over the Navy in 1911.
Yes, First Lord of the Admiralty. With war clouds gathering over Europe, he became this passionate advocate for modernizing the Royal Navy.
What kinds of things?
Crucially, the shift from coal power to oil for the ships. Huge change. And developing naval aviation. Gilbert shows he had this keen grasp of modern warfare even then, seeing the technological shifts coming. It wasn't just a job, it was active foresight.
But no life like Churchill's is smooth sailing. That period, 1914 to 1922, was a real trial by fire. Gallipoli, 1915.
Gallipoli.
It's often seen as the great stain on his record, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Gilbert details it as this catastrophic setback. He was the architect of the naval plan, became the main scapegoat. His political career looked finished.
Utterly finished, it seemed. Public humiliation.
But how does Gilbert frame that failure? Is it just a disaster or something more? A necessary, maybe brutal turning point?
Gilbert absolutely acknowledges the disaster. It haunted Churchill. But he emphasizes Churchill's incredible resilience. Instead of just fading away, the 40-year-old Churchill did something extraordinary.
What was that?
He joined the army. Served as a lieutenant colonel in the trenches in Belgium.
Wow. From the Admiralty to the trenches.
Exactly. Gilbert argues this wasn't just about restoring his reputation for courage, though it did that. It gave him invaluable firsthand experience of what ordinary soldiers faced, an understanding that deeply informed his leadership later when he led those same men as prime minister.
An incredible pivot. And it worked politically.
It did. Gilbert shows how this period ultimately brought him back. He returned to government in 1917, held various posts after the war, Secretary of State for War and Air, Colonial Secretary.
Playing a big role in redrawing the map of the Middle East, right?
A central role. It just shows his ability to rebound, his essential value to the government, even after such a massive public failure. Which brings us to what Gilbert portrays as maybe the most defining crucible for his later leadership, the wilderness years. Roughly 1923 to 1939.
Right, out of power for much of it.
A period of mixed fortunes, definitely growing political isolation. We should probably mention his controversial return to the gold standard when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1925.
Yes, fixing the pound's value to gold.
Yep.
Gilbert notes, it was widely blamed for making economic problems worse back then, hurting exports, slowing recovery. Didn't exactly boost his popularity.
No, I bet not. But the real story of these years, the crucial part, is that political isolation, isn't it? He was at odds with his own party leaders.
Completely. He became this lonely, urgent voice, warning, constantly warning, about the rising threat of Adolf Hitler and German rearmament.
While everyone else was pushing for appeasement.
Exactly. Gilbert paints this vivid picture of his warnings being dismissed. You know, the ramblings of a warmonger, someone stuck in the past. He was just screaming into the void, basically.
Why did he see it so clearly when others didn't? What does Gilbert say?
This is where Gilbert really hammers home his foresight and moral courage. He frames this period not as failure, but as the time Churchill's conviction was sharpest. He relentlessly gathered data, studied everything, argued for rearmament, while the consensus was peace at any price.
So leadership sometimes means being unpopular.
That's the core insight here. Being right can be lonely. He saw the existential threat of Nazism with total clarity, no wishful thinking. He was, effectively, Gilbert suggests, in training for 1940 during those wilderness years.
And then, 1939, war breaks out. Churchill's back at the Admiralty. The message famously went out, Winston is back.
A moment of huge relief for many in the Navy.
And then, May 1940, France is falling, Britain stands utterly alone, and at 65, he becomes prime minister. It's almost unbelievable.
It's incredibly dramatic. Gilbert shows how every previous failure, every lesson learned, had, in a way, prepared him for precisely this moment.
And his words. They became weapons, didn't they?
Absolutely. Gilbert details how Churchill's oratory, that incredible soaring language, became Britain's primary weapon. Think of those famous lines. I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat.
Chilling.
And we shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall never surrender. These weren't just speeches. Gilbert shows them as strategic assets.
How so?
They unified the nation, mobilized the will to resist, projected this image of unyielding resolve to the world, especially to America. His mastery of language, honed over decades, literally helped save the nation.
Beyond the powerful words, though, there was the strategy, the diplomacy. He was tireless, right?
Tireless. He directed the war effort through the Battle of Britain, the Blitz. But Gilbert also highlights those two crucial diplomatic achievements.
Forging the special relationship with Roosevelt.
Exactly. Instrumental in eventually bringing America into the war and managing that difficult but totally necessary alliance with Stalin.
Must have been incredibly tough.
Immensely. Gilbert shows him as this demanding, sometimes difficult, but ultimately inspiring leader who drove the war effort through sheer force of will, making impossible decisions that saved Britain, maybe saved the free world.
So let's talk about his core philosophy, his values, what really drove this incredibly complex man, according to Gilbert.
Well, several things stand out. That ambition we talked about, born from childhood, was obviously a huge driver. But it wasn't just ambition for its own sake. It was linked to a deep, almost romantic sense of history and Britain's place in it.
He saw himself as a man of destiny.
Perhaps. He certainly felt he had a role to play on a grand stage. There was also incredible pragmatism, though. We saw that with the social reforms, the naval modernization. He wasn't just an ideologue, he adapted to realities.
And resilience, obviously. That has to be a core value.
Absolutely central. The ability to take a hit, a massive hit like Gallipoli, and get back up, learn from it, and re-enter the fray. That defines him. And maybe underpinning it all was this profound belief in liberty and defiance against tyranny, which became crystal clear in the 30s and 40s.
Okay, if we had to pick three pivotal turning points from this epic life, moments that truly altered his course, what would Gilbert point to?
That's a great way to look at it. I think the first, based on Gilbert's account, has to be his escape during the Boer War.
Tell us that story again briefly.
He was a captured war correspondent, manages this incredibly daring escape from a POW camp, travels hundreds of miles through enemy territory. It instantly made him a national hero back home.
And why was it so transformative?
It gave him the public profile, the fame he needed to launch his political career immediately upon his return. Without that dramatic escape, his entry into Parliament might have been much slower, much less certain. It set the stage.
Okay, turning point one, the escape. What's number two?
It's a Gallipoli and its aftermath. The disaster itself was devastating.
The lowest point.
Arguably, yes. Scapegoated, politically ruined. But the transformation came in his response. Choosing to go to the Western Front to serve in the trenches.
Why was that the turning point, not just the failure?
Because it demonstrated his courage, rebuilt his reputation, and crucially gave him that visceral understanding of the common soldier. It humanized him and deepened his perspective in a way staying in politics couldn't have. It allowed his eventual comeback.
Right, the comeback wouldn't have happened without that detour. Okay, a third pivotal moment.
It has to be his stance against appeasement in the 1930s.
The wilderness years again.
Yes, but specifically his lonely, persistent opposition to Hitler when almost everyone else in power disagreed. It was pivotal because it cemented his credibility when war finally came.
So when disaster struck.
He was the one man who had been right all along. It made his appointment as prime minister in 1940 not just possible, but almost inevitable. His years of unpopular warnings became his greatest political asset at Britain's most desperate hour. That stand truly defined his ultimate rise to leadership.
So, reflecting on this whole life, what are the human lessons here? What can you, listening now, take away from Churchill's struggles and triumphs that feels relevant today?
Well, one thing is dealing with failure. We all face setbacks. Churchill faced colossal ones publicly. Gilbert shows how he didn't let them define him in a negative way. He absorbed them, learned, pivoted. That's a huge lesson in resilience.
It's not about not failing. It's about how you respond.
Precisely. And related to that is managing internal struggles. Yeah. Gilbert touches on his black dog, his depression. Yet he maintained this incredible work ethic, this sense of purpose. It shows you can function, even excel, while dealing with mental health challenges. Purpose can be a powerful anchor.
That's really important for people to hear, I think.
Definitely. And there's also the lesson about conviction. Standing up for what you believe in, based on your own research and understanding, even when it's deeply unpopular. That takes real courage, but sometimes it's essential.
And maybe embracing your own complexities. He wasn't simple.
Not at all. The aristocrat reformer, the imperialist freedom fighter. Gilbert shows how his contradictions were part of his strength. It suggests we shouldn't try to smooth out all our own rough edges either. Our complexities make us who we are and may be uniquely suited for certain challenges.
Okay, let's try to distill this even further. If we had to pull out three final takeaways from Gilbert's Churchill, a life, what would they be? Let's frame them as an emotional insight, an intellectual one, and a universal one.
All right. For the emotional insight, I think it has to be the power of resilience fueled by purpose. Seeing how he repeatedly came back from devastating setbacks, like Gallipoli or the wilderness years, driven by this unwavering belief in himself and his country's cause, it speaks to the human spirit's capacity to endure and overcome when anchored to something bigger than oneself.
That hits deep. Okay, an intellectual insight.
I'd point to the strategic importance of foresight combined with principled communication. His lonely warnings about Hitler weren't just opinions, they were based on deep study. And his ability to then articulate the stakes, to use language not just to inform but to mobilize a nation, that's a profound intellectual lesson in leadership, knowing what's coming and being able to convey it effectively.
Understanding and articulating. Got it. And finally, a universal insight, something practical for everyone listening.
I think it's the imperative of lifelong learning as preparation for the unknown. Churchill was constantly reading, writing, studying history. He built this vast mental toolkit. It wasn't about formal education ending. It was continuous self-education. That's universally applicable. The more you learn and prepare across different fields, the better equipped you are to face whatever unexpected challenges life throws your way. You're building your own arsenal for your own finest hour, whatever that might be.
Powerful takeaways. Resilience and purpose, foresight and communication, and lifelong learning. It really paints a picture, doesn't it? Martin Gilbert's biography shows that greatness isn't some innate gift. It's forged through relentless struggle, continuous learning, and yes, that improbable resilience. The hero of 1940 was built on decades of earlier failures and disappointments.
Yeah.
A profoundly human journey.
Absolutely. So here's a final thought for you to consider. In our world, with so much information, so much pressure to conform, where do you find the courage? The courage to cultivate your own deep convictions, to learn from every single setback, and to speak your truth, even when it's unpopular. How might your unique, complex journey be preparing you right now for a moment only you can truly meet?
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.